The Voice of America presents John F. Kennedy, A Personal Memory.
It was so alive in the White House. It really was.
He gave everyone that ever met him confidence.
I think he was the most brilliant and able member of my own generation.
It was the quality of greatness. He was an unusual man.
John F. Kennedy, A Personal Memory. A reminiscence of the late President Kennedy by four persons who knew him intimately, who worked with him, who loved him, who shared many moments of his life. John F. Kennedy, A Personal Memory. A portrait by four who were there.
I'm Evelyn Lincoln. I was the personal secretary to the president from January 3rd, 1953, until November 22nd, 1963.
This is Arthur Schlesinger, Jr.
Now, this is Ted Sorensen, special counsel to the president.
This is David F. Powers, presidential assistant.
The beginnings of these recollections lie back in history, in the year 1946, when John F. Kennedy was recently returned from the war in the Pacific and decided to go into politics. Dave Powers remembers those beginnings.
Well, I first met him in 1946 when he was a candidate for a vacant seat in the House of Representatives. I had just returned from the China-Burma-India theater. And it was January 1946 when a knock came on my door in Charlestown, Massachusetts. And when I answered the door, I saw this tall, thin, handsome fellow. He put out his hand and said, "I'm Jack Kennedy, and I am a candidate for Congress. Will you help me?"
Dave Powers agreed. He worked with Jack Kennedy during his successful campaign for Congress, then for the Senate, and then finally on the long, long struggle in 1960 for nomination as the Democratic candidate for President of the United States. And he remembers the cold and the bleakness and the fatigue of some of those early campaign trips, and how he and Ken O'Donnell, another member of the Kennedy team, traveled with the young senator from Massachusetts, and how it was with him.
I can remember being with him in Wisconsin, and it meant starting as early as 5 in the morning and finishing as late as 2. At one occasion, the president and Ken O'Donnell and I are in a, he got to bed at 2:30 in the morning, and Ken O'Donnell and I are going over the schedule for the next day when Ken said, "Oh my God, he's supposed to get up at 6 in the morning." And he'd shake hands outside the gates of a huge plan. And this particular one, if he arrived there by 6 and stayed there until 9, he would have the opportunity of shaking approximately 2,000 hands. Well, I agreed to walk through the bedroom around 5:30. And if he awakened, I would tell him what was in store for the day, which is exactly what happened. As I walked through, the president, you know, who could go to sleep at any time, also would wake up with any type of noise. As I walked in, he said, "Who is it?" And I said, "It's Dave Powers." He said, "What time is it?" I said, 5:30. He said, "What are you doing here?" And as I'm telling him about the day's schedule, he's already getting dressed, and I heard him say, "What are we waiting for?" Well, in the darkness, he's standing beside a clock where they're punching in, and Ken O'Donnell and I are passing out literature and buttons, and you can hear him saying over and over again, "I am Senator John F. Kennedy, candidate for president," over and over. And we don't see him until about the first hour and a half we could hear him and not seeing. And now as it brightened up, the next hour and a half, we could both see him and hear him. And at 9 o'clock, when all the workers had gone in, we walk across the street. It was a combination tavern and place for a coffee and a sandwich. And we're three of us are drinking coffee out of a paper cup. And I notice the president's hand, his right hand, is swollen and blue and bloody, where in the darkness he wasn't catching a full hand, he was catching a fingernail here and there. And I can always remember him picking up the paper cup and saying, "This is pretty good coffee, isn't it?"
The road to nomination, a long road, a tiring road. But finally, it reached its end. And his secretary, Evelyn Lincoln, remembers that exciting night when the Democratic Convention nominated him for the presidency of the United States.
We had a TV, and the lights blew a fuse just as Alabama was starting to count. And so we got that fixed. It blew three times, so we missed the first few. But then when it got down to Wyoming, and everybody shouted, "We just need 11 more," and he said, "Oh, there's Teddy." And then, of course, he was nominated, and everybody jumped up. And his first reaction was to call Mrs. Kennedy. So he said for me to get her on the telephone immediately.
Nominated for president, half of the great goal gained, the ultimate decision in the hands of the people of the United States. All over the land on election day, Americans went to their polling places and cast their votes. When the decision was rendered, John F. Kennedy was the president-elect of the United States. Mrs. Lincoln and Dave Powers remember those first shining hours when John F. Kennedy sat in his new office in the White House as president.
He was over to the office before any of us, and he walked over to my desk and he says, "Is there any mail?"
The first day, the office seemed sort of big for him. You know, he was used to having people closer to him, and he'd be pressing buttons on his desk, and he'd press one, and Evelyn Lincoln would come in a side door, and he'd go, "Oh, is that where you are?" And then he'd press another, and Ken O'Donnell would come running. And I was out at the reception desk then, and finally around 10:30, he got to that button, and right away the boys working for me, Mitch and Tom and Roger, got all excited, and says, "The president." And as I started in, he started out. And by noon that day, he knew where everyone's office was. He just couldn't wait for them to come in. He went after them. And he walked around upstairs and downstairs until he knew where everybody's office was, and then he'd talk to them on the phone and ask them how they liked being there.
What was life like in the White House with President Kennedy? Mrs. Lincoln, Arthur Schlesinger, and Dave Powers recall it.
Before he would come over, he would call and find out what his first appointment was. And then he would come over and he'd want to see his mail. Then my talk with several of the assistants in the White House, and then he would start his appointments.
President Kennedy was very accessible. And at the end of every morning and the end of every afternoon, he ordinarily would have leave time free in his schedule. At such times, when the door was open between Mrs. Lincoln's office, his secretary's office, and his own office, it meant that he welcomed members of his staff dropping in. And at that time, anyone who had anything to take up with the president could go over and stick your head in the door, and he'd say, "Come on in."
He would talk to staff members, and then he never got away from the office until maybe 1:30, 1:15 to 1:30, and he'd go over and take a swim in the pool, then go up and have his lunch, and he'd have his lunch in bed, and he'd be reading constantly the whole time, and then he would relax maybe for 30 to 45 minutes. Then he'd come back to the office, and he'd carry on again, and never left the office until maybe 7:30 and 8.
And he never stopped working. The president tried to use up every minute of every day, even at mealtime. He'd be reading or writing, and even in the pool. a thought would come to him, the swimming would relax him, and he'd say, Dave, would you tell Ken O'Donnell I want to see, and he'd mention someone that he wanted to see at, say, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock. And his day was never done. He'd take all the papers over to the room with him and try to be as prepared as you possibly could be for tomorrow's meetings. And after a while, he knew more about what was going on than anyone there.
Did all this interfere with his personal and family life?
He had a way of separating the business on hand from his family. He had his private life and his political life, and he worked that way with friends, too, that sort of had a way of fitting everyone in and everything in so that one never blocked another or interfered with another.
The chief of state of a nation of almost 200 million people. How did he view the office of the presidency? Mr. Schlesinger and Mr. Sorensen comment on it.
He saw the office of the presidency as one of the great instruments of the world, in the world, with which to get things done. He had a great historic sense of the dignity and the possibilities of the office. He enjoyed the exercise of power. Power did not make him feel unhappy or guilty or cause him to lose sleep. But he always subordinated power to the objectives, the goals for which power might be used.
The single outstanding quality he had as president, perhaps, was his ability to remain himself at all times, whether it was a moment of great triumph or a moment of tragedy. He remained calm, objective, easily approachable. At times of success, he knew that a darker moment would come again. At times when things looked most dark, he knew it would not be long before there was light.
He saw life in terms of irony, of certain irony. There was about him always this quality of a certain ironic gaiety and sparkle. And this enabled him to distance himself, so to speak, from problems, and gave him that detachment, which was a great source of his strength and his control. But at the same time, it never severed the nerve of decision or the flow of commitment.
He became more sober and serious as the burdens of the office weighed upon him, but he never lost his basic sense of humor and his ability to laugh at himself and to take the world seriously but not take himself too seriously.
You could tell by the kind of twinkle in his eye that he was going to say something real funny. But he always had a sense of humor. I mean, things, even though in the serious part of things and negotiations and things like that, he always had a release by maybe making some little remark which would relieve the tension. People were all tensed up, but he could say some little thing but relieve it.
John F. Kennedy was loved not only by his own countrymen, but by those same citizens of the world to whom he had extended the hand of friendship and joint endeavor in his inaugural address. For wherever he went, his charm reached out to the people, and the people responded. Mrs. Lincoln and Mr. Sorensen remember it.
I could talk on end about the people that lined the streets. It just was fantastic. And the thing of it that impressed me the most was the fact that I'd say that 50% of them were children, and they would have flags and homemade signs. And it was just marvelous, the children, they it just seemed like they had a goal and they had a hero, that they really did go all out for him. And it was the same way overseas. In Paris, the people were so exuberant. And I never will forget in West Berlin. That was just out of this world. It really was. The people were hanging from the roofs and out the windows. You couldn't get another person in that square.
From the moment we left the plane that morning to the moment we entered the plane late that afternoon, there was the most intense atmosphere of excitement and joy on the part of the people of West Berlin. All of them turned out at some place along the president's route. In their eyes, in their voices, in their smiles and waves, they showed great love and respect for him and for the United States. They showed that they had new hope and determination as a result of what he had helped make possible. And it was a wonderful welcome, which I know overwhelmed him. He said that he thought he would never have a day like that again as long as he lived. And of course, it turned out he did not live very long, but had he lived 50 more years, I think his prophecy probably would have been correct.
What was the secret of that appeal?
I don't know. Really, I used to say that one thing that I would love if somebody could ride in the president's car and get the look on the people's faces as he passed. It was just like a glow on their face, and the girls would stand and just in awe, and they'd say, "He looked at me. He smiled at me." It was just something. It was a magnetic appeal he had. And just a wave of the hand. And ever so many people have come in to me and said, "I really knew him. He waved at me in the crowd." That's all they had. But they felt they knew him. And on his last trip to Dallas, it was miraculous, the people that were lining the streets. And I said as we went through the main part of Dallas and we hit the freeway, I said, "Gee, I don't know when I've seen such a people that were so pleased to see the president." And they really were. That was the last group.
But the life of a president of the United States is measured not only by triumph or tragedy, but by the constant crises he has to meet day after day, month after month, while he is in office.
The president was always at his best when things were darkest. Going back at the time that he was going on television to explain to the American people the opposition in Berlin in relation to the wall. And then later, when the Russians had dropped the highest megaton ever. And then later, during the eyeball-to-eyeball crisis in Cuba. When the going gets tough, the tough get going, because President Kennedy was always at his best when he had to.
He was aware of the enormous stakes involved for this country, for the future of mankind, and he could personalize that in terms of his own children as well as the children of all the world.
The view from the White House is different from the view any other place in the land. It must be so, for the ultimate decision must always be the president's. It is, in last analysis, his alone.
He made decisions alone by himself often, but the loneliness of presidential decisions does not refer to the number of people who are in the room when the decision is made. It refers to the fact that truly only the president can make a major decision, and no matter how many advisors he has in the room or out of the room, only he can make that final decision, and in that sense, it's a very lonely process, no matter how crowded the environment may be.
Because a man is president does not mean that he ceases to be a man. Problems that plague everyone on this earth also touch the president. Illness and physical pain.
I think one other thing ought to be remembered about President Kennedy, and that is that as a very early in his administration, when he went to Canada, he assisted in the planting of a tree and strained his back. His back had always been weak. The strain renewed an ancient injury dating from the war. And from that day thereafter, he was always in pain. At times it was a very acute, at times it was quiescent, but it was always a limitation on the activity of a very active man.
He never complained. He sort of sometimes might have an idea by some of his silence that maybe his back was bothering him, but he never ever complained. He disliked maybe someone that might whimper about something like that. You know, he used to like people that were willing to stand up and be counted. But he never complained, and it was great about him.
It meant, for example, that he couldn't pick up his children and throw them in the air as he would like to have done and as his fathers would do. It meant that he always, leaning over, had to be careful, and meant the rocker.
What about the children? Did the president often talk of his fondness for them?
He didn't mention it because Kennedy was not given to personal talk, but he displayed it constantly in his actions and in the obvious delight with which he viewed the occasional invasions of his office by his own children and their friends. I remember so often in a summer or autumn afternoon, late at the end of the day, when he would feel a sense of confinement in the office and would like to go out and stroll up and down in the colonnade right outside his office. And then if you saw a child playing in the distance, he would clap his hands. And as he clapped his hands, all children, all dogs within earshot would come running to him. And this was a great, obviously, source of relaxation and delight for him.
John would be out in the south lawn, and he'd see him, and he'd go out and he'd clap his hands, and John would come pell-mell across the yard and run in there and be so happy, and of course I always had a plate of candy, and he'd come out there and get a piece of candy, and then also Caroline and her schoolmates would come out and play out near her playground out there, and they might all come in sometime and get candy, or maybe she'd come in as she was going back into the White House just to see him and say hello. And it didn't make any difference who was in there. If the most important person in the world was sitting in there, he had time to say hello to her and introduce her to whoever was there. It was very, very nice family relationship. And Mrs. Kennedy would stop in. If she'd be out on the South grounds, she'd stop in, see what was going on, and say hello. Very, very friendly.
Each afternoon, at the close of his office day, President Kennedy would find time to spend with his children.
The nurse would bring them over, maybe around between 7 and 7:15, And they'd sit in my office. Maybe he still would have someone in there with him. And then as soon as they'd leave, well, he'd come out and they'd go into his office or they'd be in my office. And they just romped and played. They really did. I used to say that if people could see the President of the United States on the floor with his two children, they would really be pleased. And he just dearly loved those children. And they did too. They thought so much of him.
The story will live as long as there is memory to hold it. The tragedy will continue to be felt by every citizen of the nation which he led so brilliantly. Not only this generation, but those to come. But the contribution he made to his country, like the eternal flame over his grave, will long endure. Mr. Sorensen?
In a general sense, his greatest contribution was that he was the author of a new birth of hope in this country and in this world. People had more hope in the prospects of peace. They had more faith in their fellow man as a result of his urgings on civil rights. They had more hope that the United States would live up to its own greatness and destiny.
Mr. Powers?
He got greater. One time, Bob Healy, he's a writer for the Boston Globe and a good friend of ours, he heard me calling President Kennedy Mr. President. And he said, "God, Dave, you have known him since 1946, and you still call him Mr. President." And I said, "Bob, every time I see him, he looks more like Mr. President than the day before. That I never, ever, I'd walk into that office every day, and he seemed to grow taller."
Mrs. Lincoln?
He really inspired me. He really did. I'm sure that when we pick up the pieces, well, there'll be a purpose.
Mr. Schlesinger?
Of course, one of the most tragic aspects of the affair is the incompleteness of his presidency. It's difficult to anticipate the judgment of history. But I personally will feel that historians in the future will look upon the Kennedy administration as a period of exceptional brilliance, the time when America recovered the creative and vitalities which have always marked the points of greatest American influence and greatest American achievement.
John F. Kennedy, a personal memory. A reminiscence of the late President of the United States by four who knew him, worked with him, loved him. Ted Sorensen, Mrs. Evelyn Lincoln, Arthur Schlesinger, Jr., David F. Powers.